So my name's Sean Lucan. I'm a family doctor in the Bronx, and most of the patients that I take care of are urban, low-income minority patients who suffer disproportionately from obesity and diet-related diseases. And I've been frustrated clinically in trying to change dietary behaviors through clinical counseling and have increasingly become interested in the environmental context within which patients make dietary decisions and talking about the food environment. So I have nothing to disclose other than the fact that I'm not alone in this interest. And so that's obvious from the presentations today. And also obvious from this graph, which was put together by Sharon Kirkpatrick, Jill Reedy, and Robin McKinnon from the National Cancer Institute. And what it just shows is food environment studies over the last 20 years. And you can see there's really just been an explosion in this kind of research in the last decade. So lots of people interested in this area, lots of studies being done. But predominantly, and this is a figure from another presentation by that same group at National Cancer Institute, most people are focusing on food stores and restaurants. There's been some attention to schools, less homework and other environments. But nobody is really talking about this. And so, you know, I ask myself, what about the guys selling food on the street? What about the mobile food environment in urban settings? So it might be particularly important, particularly in communities like mine, like in the Bronx and New York and other urban areas. And so that's what I wanted to look into. The other thing that you note when you look at past studies of the food environment is that they generally take one of two basic approaches. So a macro-level approach, kind of bird's-eye view, looking down, mapping GIS studies, how many fast food outlets per census tract, what's the distance to the nearest grocery store, that kind of consideration. And then there's on-the-ground micro-level assessments where people go into restaurants and food stores and use checklists and menu assessments and market baskets to determine what's being sold. So I wanted to take kind of a combination approach and apply that to street vendors. So these are my objectives. So macro level, where are the street vendors? And on the micro level, what are they selling? And then other objectives were to assess reproducibility or reliability, like what's the constancy of the presence, location, and offerings at these mobile vendors, right? Because they are not part of the fixed environment. They can move and be anywhere. And then the logistics of, you know, scaling this up and doing it in other boroughs, other cities, other municipalities across the country. So just to give you some background, this is the Bronx, in the interest of time, I'm going to just gloss over this. But this is New York City. And you know what I think? I think this didn't update with my new file. Well, that's okay. I'll work with the old file. This is New York City, five boroughs, Bronx being the one in the upper corner, and all this is meant to demonstrate is that those big obese circles up there are big obese people. The dark colors represent people consuming more sugar-sweetened beverages. You'd get a very similar picture if you were looking at low fruit and vegetable consumption, incidence of diabetes, incidence of heart disease. So it's an area of particular concern where my practice is and the patients that I see, and so something that you know, I wanted to address. So the way that I did this, and this is where you gotta love students, because students will do things that no reasonable person would ever do. Specifically drive in the Bronx. So this is a borough where people will routinely turn left from the right lane, right from the left lane, always without signaling, stop without notice, double and triple park, and just create traffic catastrophes. So the fact that they are willing to drive any of the streets was remarkable, and they drove all of the streets in the Bronx. So a not trivial task. And so the plan was to have them go out. We'd pre-plan a route using Google Maps. One person would drive. The other person would look for street vendors, identify a vendor, park the vehicle, secure the vehicle, mark the map, approach the vendor. They'd give their IDs, identify themselves. One would ask the vendor questions. One would make observations. Return to the vehicle and repeat, and then we'd look at the data every day. Importantly, I want these students to look as unofficial as possible. Sneakers, jeans, baseball caps, backpacks, etc., and I'll get into why that was important in a minute. And then just serendipitously, both of my students happened to be bilingual, English and Spanish, and that proved to be very important for reasons that I'll get into. So not knowing that my students were going to be bilingual, I actually had the questions translated into a couple languages. So this is the Spanish and Bengali versions. These were very simple, basic questions. So what days is the cart, truck, or stand usually here? What hours are you usually here? Do you ever go anywhere else? If so, where? What months does the stand come out? Are you here regardless of the weather? And how long have you been here, you know, in total, a number of years? So just some basic, very basic information. And then the observations, so we wanted to look at where these street vendors are. So we had to identify them, so we needed either a permit number, license number, or some other unique attribute to make sure we weren't double counting them and that we could recognize them when they were there. We needed a location, so that was either the exact street address, nearest cross street, or the nearest building. And then landmarks, you know, is it near a subway, is it near a hospital, is it near a department store? And I'm not going to go into the spatial distribution so much today, so I'm giving another talk next hour for people interested where I'll talk specifically about green carts and how they're spatially arranged. The other thing that I wanted to look at was the number and kind of foods and beverages available. So we did this looking at menu boards, talking to the vendors, looking at their product displays. And again, I'm not going to give so much detail about that here. I'm giving another talk tomorrow if you're interested in what we actually found and what people were selling. Today I want to focus more on the method of doing the research itself and the reproducibility and logistics. So I wanted to see, you know, given this mobile environment, how constant is it? So we had to look at cart mobility. So they could either be functionally mobile, like a hot dog stand that people could wheel along and walk anywhere, or functionally stationary, like a wooden table set up with fruit and vegetables on it that people would have to pack up, load into a van to move somewhere during the day. I wanted to look at the time that they were selling, when they were selling and when they reported selling, and whether weather played into played in as a consideration. So certainly some of these vendors are exposed to the elements. So think, you know, the hot dog vendor, the snow cone vendor who's outside, whereas other vendors like lunch trucks, ice cream trucks are protected. And then I wanted to assess, you know, what's the difficulty in obtaining information. So language barriers could be an issue, other interview difficulties, and then any other comments. And so specifically, I wanted students to talk about, you know, legal considerations, competition from bricks and mortar establishments, etc. So this is just an example of one of the Google Maps. We print out a map with kind of an itinerary. The students would trace their way along. So the dark line you see is just them tracing with a pencil. And you can't really see, but they're marking street vendors as they go. And at the end of the day, they would make this composite map saying where they were. So that star that right there is us at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And the numbers here represent the days. So the 1, 2, and 3 is the area that they looked at during the first, second, and third day. And this is not a small space. So this is over 40 square miles of dense urban jungle and terrible traffic. So they should be applauded and probably medaled. But in any case, so it took a long time. So it took 40 days of full-time effort for two students to do 100% of the Bronx. They found 372 vendors, which is about 10 per square mile, but as I'll talk about next session, you know, the distribution was far from even. And in terms of the constancy or the reliability, you know, vendors move. So 30% reported moving, either going to different streets, different neighborhoods, or sometimes different boroughs. And 70% could easily move. So if the, you know, if the mood struck them and they thought they could do better somewhere else during the day, they could just get up and pick up, go somewhere else. This was predominantly a seasonal phenomenon, street vending. So mostly people were out April to October, although there was some variation around that. And only a quarter of vendors were out all year long. In terms of days of the week, only a minority, so only a third, sold all 7 days of the week. So again, some variation in the environment. The vast majority did sell on some Monday through Friday, and over 50% sold on some Saturday and Sunday, but 5% was completely random. Generally, this was, you know, kind of a late business kind of phenomenon, so 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., although some variation around that. And what's interesting about the time vending is that while there were some veterans out there that had been out for over 25 years, a full 10% of the sample was there less than a month. So it just suggests that the denominator is shifting. People are entering into the market. So more vendors are hitting the street, you know, almost on a daily basis. And then weather was a big concern. So only 14% of vendors would go out rain or shine. And that mostly correlated with who was protected from the elements or not, but not completely, because if vendors don't think that they're going to do good business, it might not be worth their time or effort to go out if they don't think pedestrians are going to be on the street. All right, and then in terms of logistics. So of the 372 vendors, we did interviews, full interviews, or asked questions with about two-thirds. And about a third we weren't able to interview. And the reasons for not interviewing half the time was that they were moving around. They were in motion, in transit. So if an ice cream truck is driving down the street, you know, obviously the students can't ask them what they're selling or do any assessment. So we just noted that. So when interviews did occur, most of the time they were not difficult. However, a good portion of the time there was a language barrier. And of note, 76%, this was surprising to me, 76%, so a full three-quarters of all the vendors either preferred or only spoke Spanish exclusively. So I was very fortunate to have Spanish-speaking research assistants. We really couldn't have collected this data without that, just kind of good stroke of fortune. The thing I want to note here is that the other reason interviews were often difficult is because vendors were reluctant or nervous, and sometimes they just outright refused. And the reason for that probably relates in good part to this, so competition. Competition we defined, so we looked five business addresses up, five business addresses down on both sides of the street, and if, you know, if a snow cone vendor is selling near an ice cream shop, or if a produce vendor is selling near a supermarket, we considered that competition. And the thing is, the restaurants and stores, the bricks and mortar, they don't like the vendors. They view them as competition, as, you know, taking away from their business. And so they work with the police to exert pressure and hassle these guys. And so the last thing you want to do is come around looking official, like a regulatory agency or like someone who can exert punitive measures. So you want, you know, people going around in sneakers and baseball hats, and still there's some reluctance to talk. The other problem is that only a third of all the vendors we found were potentially legal. So only a third had a visible permit or license, and some were clearly illegitimate, right? So people selling watermelons out of the backs of vans, people selling, you know, homemade, you know, Spanish baked goods on top of like you know, push cart that you would use for groceries. So lots of informal kind of setups. So the bottom line here is, for people that would want to look at this in the future, okay, and I would encourage people to look at this in the future, because this is an element of the food environment that people aren't really talking about and probably should be, and I'll get into that in my talk tomorrow, is that this is a shifting target. It's a moving target, right? And so it's difficult to assess. So the thing you have to remember is that these guys can move, and they do. And, you know, their presence and location vary by day, date, time, and weather significantly. Also, new vendors are coming onto the market, so the denominator is growing. And, you know, given that there's the pressure from the bricks and mortar, that most of them are illegitimate, and the vendors are generally going to be reluctant to talk to you, and particularly if you don't speak their language. So it's going to be important to make sure that you can communicate in a language that's comfortable and not intimidating and not looking like you're going to, you know, exert any kind of negative consequences to their business or livelihood or otherwise. So anyway, that's the methods in a nutshell. Like I said, later today, I'm going to be talking about kind of the spatial arrangements of green carts. Tomorrow I'll be talking about what the food vendors were actually selling. I'm happy to talk more about this or other issues. My email's there, and I'd be happy to take questions now if anyone has any.